So it's wonderful to see all of you and to welcome you back, Yohevet, from your trip to Antarctica. It's wonderful to sit together again. So this morning we have a chance to reflect on Vayakalpikudei. We've been reflecting on the Torah readings that describe the instructions for and the building of the Mishkan, our portable sanctuary in the wilderness. And as we've done this together, I've become more aware in my meditation practice and in my daily life of the invisible structures that shape, organize, contain, and constrain my behavior, my thinking, really my whole experience of life. These structures could be our daily routines, weekly routines, the grammar rules that shape the way we think about and talk about things, the rituals of lighting candles or saying prayers at specific times, the religious imagery of the Mishkan, the rituals surrounding the big, momentous life transitions like birth, the adolescent passage, marriage, death. These rituals give sharper, clearer edges to the more elusive, invisible structures of our inner experience. And so the imagery of the Mishkan, the portable sanctuary where Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh can dwell within us, this in our current Torah reading is a metaphor that brings us into greater awareness of the structures that shape all of our experience. In this week's Torah reading, Vayakel, we emerge from the intense unions, confrontations, rifts, and reunions of last week's portion, Ki Tisa, and we return to the soothing and beautiful group activities of building the Mishkan together. As we discussed in last week's talk, Rabbi Alan Liu draws our attention to a literary construction, the chiasmus, that creates an invisible structure. It's used in poetry or rhetoric. It can be a two-part poem or phrase in which the second half mirrors the first. It comes from the Greek word meaning X, a visual symbol in which the second half mirrors the first half. And the cross point, the nodal point, is at the center. So in our five Torah readings, the first two parshiot, Truma and Tetzaveh, in those God communicates privately, secretly to Moses, the instructions for building the Mishkan. And in the last two parshiot, Vayakel and Pikudei, that we read this week, Moses communicates to all the people, all the Israelites, these same instructions, bringing them together to build the actual structure described in the first two parshiot. And in the center is Ki Tisa, which captures both the desperate longing of the people for something to worship, which turns out to be the golden calf, and the desperate longing of Moses for clearer connection to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. As we read these five Torah readings, we also enter into and emerge from the sacred space of connection with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh through the literary structure of the chiasmus and through the metaphoric imagery of entering into and leaving the Mishkan. Aviva Zornberg has an even more detailed reading of these parshiot, and so she points out another chiasmus. In Ki Tisa, God finishes inscribing the words of Torah on the two tablets, a up on the mountaintop. And he finishes by giving Moses the instructions for the Mishkan. He explains that Bezalel has been endowed with a divine skill for every craft needed. And then God finishes the instructions saying, "Nevertheless, you must tell the people to keep my Shabbat," making it clear that the holy work of building the Mishkan should not displace the holiness of rest on Shabbat. And immediately after that, we read, when God finished speaking with Moses on Mount Sinai, God gave Moses the two tablets of the pact, the stone tablets inscribed with the finger of God. Yes, you're thinking, yes, the tablets, we know where this is going. And in the next moment, in chapter 32, we read, when the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered against Aaron and said to him, "Come make us a God who shall go before us, for that man Moses, who brought us from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has happened to him." So as we emerge from this section about the intense longing for connection with the divine, both by the people and by Moses, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, the order of God's instructions to Moses, first for the Mishkan and then Shabbat, are reversed as we emerge. Because at the start of this week's Parsha, by Yakel, Moses conveys these two sets of the instructions in the opposite order. First, Moses explains the critical importance of Shabbat, that on the seventh day no work will be done, and then Moses goes on to give the people instructions for donating to and building the Mishkan. So this is the chiasmus. It goes Mishkan, Shabbat, from God, longing for connection at the center, and then as we come out Mishkan, we come out Shabbat first, and then Mishkan. And so this is Moses reversing the order of the instructions that he got from God as he gives the instructions to the people. And needless to say, this reversal has inspired commentary on the relative importance of temple practice versus the observance of Shabbat. And needless to say, the observance of Shabbat is the most important, our day of rest. And we refrain from work. And how is work defined? It's defined by the 39 tasks that were involved in building the Mishkan. So the reasons for this juxtaposition could be many. Some commentaries suggest that the building of the Mishkan, the structure in which we invite Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh to dwell among us, might seem so important that the Israelites would assume that they would work every day and disregard the day of work in order to follow these instructions for building a holy space and getting it ready. And the reversal makes it clear that all work must cease, including holy work. Now, while I've read these passages many times, I've been confused by the chronology many times. This week, when I studied it, I had a new understanding of the invisible structure of this chiasmus and the holy space in the middle, highlighting something I had never thought of before. Now, in different Torah study classes, we've often discussed what was the actual chronology, and at this moment, I'm going to say that doesn't matter right now in the sense of what happens to us as we read these parshiot and we follow this sequence from instructions that are given but not yet transmitted or received by the people to this empty space and then later the giving and the instructions. Like most of us, I've been familiar with the story of the golden calf, and like most of us, I'm familiar with Moses begging to see God face to face. As a matter of fact, we do a meditation that Rabbi Jeff Roth has in one of his books on Jewish meditation, just on the second part of this sequence, God telling Moses God's name, the 13 attributes that we repeat many times on Yom Kippur, and we chanted the Nigun at the beginning of our meditation today. But it was really only this week, in reviewing this invisible structure of this confusing chronology, that something became clear to me, that in the empty space between God's instructions to Moses and Moses is transmitting these to the people and the people receiving them, there are two different but parallel stories of longing for a more visible connection to the divine. The people haven't seen Moses for 40 days, and they beg for a God they can see. And despite Moses' ability to talk with God, as the Torah says, face to face at the entrance of the tent of meeting, Moses still begs, "Let me behold your presence. Hareini na et kvodo." But when I read these lines in Hebrew, I realized that here Moses is not saying in Hareini na et kvodo, he's not saying, "Let me see you face to face," which is often what I thought about it. But Hareini na et kvodo, pray, let me see your glory, is one way that this is translated. And God answers in a strange way that has been beautifully illuminated by Rabbi Jeff Roth's commentary on the next passage that we often use as a meditation on Yom Kippur. God answers, "I will let my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim before you the name Lord and the grace that I grant and the compassion that I show. But you cannot see my face, for man may not see me and live. See, there is a place near me. Station yourself on the rock, and as my presence passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock and shield you with my hand until I pass by. Then I will take my hand away, and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." And Rabbi Jeff Roth explains that when God passes with his back turned to Moses, Moses is looking out from the mountain, aligned with God's line of vision, and Moses can see the world as if through God's eyes, and that view is described in the 13 attributes, Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum V'Chanun, with a vision of ultimate, seeing with ultimate compassion, perceiving with ultimate compassion. So this indirect answer to Moses' request, it's his request here, "How can I know you? How can I be leading these difficult people without more support from you?" This reminds us of Moses' first encounter with God, when Moses asked in a moment of fear, not feeling up to the task, "Who shall I say sent me?" And God answers, "Ehye asher ehye," I will be what I will be, or the unfolding of being, as we often say. And here again, in Kitisa, Moses is again feeling insecure because God did say after the golden calf incident, "I will not be dwelling among you, lest my anger flare out and destroy you." And perhaps this is one reason for Moses' yearning in these passages, in addition to it being so difficult to be a leader for these people, of begging for reassurance about who will be leading them, who will be giving Moses leadership, and how compassionate will God be in the long run. Moses knows God will have to be pretty compassionate to deal with these difficult people. And then this dramatic meeting of Moses and God is followed by God's instruction for a covenantal relationship. Like, yes, we are in this covenantal relationship. And in that, we dedicate our firstborn of every species to God, and God vows to protect us from all our enemies. And unfortunately, the compassionate God here is just a few verses later, after being the God of ultimate compassion, represented as telling us to wipe out all the religious symbols of the people who reside in the promised land, lest the Israelites make a different covenantal relationship with other gods. Now, of course, we could understand this, that God had just recently felt spurned by these people who danced around a golden calf, because Moses was a little bit late getting down from the mountain. So we can perhaps understand God's jealousy and God's lack of trust of the people. That if the Israelites came across new shiny idols in the new land, they might quickly abandon God for a more concrete idol. So again, there's this tension between the seen and the unseen. After a few more instructions about the covenant and how to observe it with rituals and sacrifices, and after Moses has written down the terms of the covenant on the tablets, Moses returns to the people, the skin of his face radiant from his communication with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And immediately after, Moses conveys the instructions in this parsha, first for Shabbat and then for the Mishkan. Now, what follows after is a description of this beautiful, divinely inspired generosity and collaboration. The people give more than enough to build and accessorize the Mishkan. And they all work together. So in reading these passages about this collaborative project, I was trying to think whether there has been any truly collaborative project of the people in the whole timeline between the Tower of Babel, which didn't turn out so well, and the golden calf, and now the building of the Mishkan. So the sense of shared activity in these passages is beautiful and soothing. And it made me think of how often art is used therapeutically. It's used individually, so people, especially children, can give nonverbal expression to difficult experiences. But also as a group intervention, when stressed people work together to build something beautiful, the shared activity, even the rhythmic repetitive movements described here of sewing and hammering together, this synchronous activity has a calming effect on the nervous system, leading, as we found in social experiments and research on how people respond to different situations, leading to more trusting and collaborative interactions. So in addition to all the other spiritual instructions given, perhaps the instructions to build and sew and make beautiful things together were part of this divinely inspired therapeutic intervention for these traumatized refugees who need to become one people. The project is similar to collaborative art expressed by other people and also exemplified by our beautiful quilt project at TBC and also by all the ways we each bring our gifts to contribute to this community and the invisible structures we create together that contain our shared practice.